Well, that's the Soweto String Quartet with Imbube, we know it popularly as Wimowe, from their 1996 album, Renaissance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Patrice Lead. It is Friday, March the 28th. My gosh, where does the time go? And it's Free Your Mind Friday. So let's get to it. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what's on your mind. All the stories that we've covered and more besides. You must have an opinion or two to render. So let's hear what you have to say. We're going to get started right away. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Utrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Well, you know how the Republicans and, well, all the politicians, but in particular, most of the politicians, but in particular the Republicans want to privatize the commons? Well, I thought of a way to privatize my way into profit. And the other day I bought the worldwide rights to the letter A, and I'm working on secret negotiations to buy the letter B. I got the letter A from my friend Frank. He told me it was in his family for several generations, but they fell on hard times, and he had to sell it, and he thought of me first. He's a sweetheart.
So what does having the rights to the letter A do for you?
Well, you know, anyone who uses the letter A, I get a royalty payment, and it's retroactive, I found out. And all the cash that I'm going to make, I'm going to buy with the letter A, I'm going to buy the rest of the alphabet. And with the money I make with that, I'm going to buy all the numbers.
And
yeah, I'm going to be the richest guy in the whole world thanks to the privatization, you know, thanks. So I just want you to know I'm going to, that's my
perfect
idea. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot. And
you know, if you were, it tells me you're not a Scrabble player. If you were a Scrabble player, you would have chosen the letter E. It's the most frequently recurring letter.
I know, and lawyers are going to owe me big.
Well, we needed a little jolt. Thanks a lot for that call.
Thanks, Eugene. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Hello, Sarah. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings, Utrice.
Thank you.
Utrice, first of all, thank you and thanks to the PRN listening audience. I've had a few listeners that are listening online who want to remain incognito, so they will be calling in to help bolster the show. And Utrice, if I may say so, and Gary and the staff listening out here, we need to give Utrice an extra half an hour, maybe an extra hour on this air. So if you can tell us what we need to do to get this to make this happen, if of course it's okay with your scheduling, because we know that you are a busy woman and you have other things
yeah.
to do.
Well, what it would take is we just need to build on what we have, and I like the idea of doing just that, building on what we have.
Okay, you three.
That's the main thing.
Yes, ma'am, I will definitely do it, but let me start off and say I hope you enjoy, have an enjoyable weekend, and once again, the same goes for all of the listening audience and the staff of the PRN. What I wanted to free my mind about on you, Therese, it has to do with the feminism, this being Women's History Month, and we had touched on this topic briefly before. And one of the things that I always tell people, always talk about is the coalition building. We are women, we are all the same, and of course, we know as black women, having Caribbean heritage where it's somewhat, we have that extra things with us and with the family situation. I don't know if you happen to see, I happened to look on Showtime, I believe it was, they did this biography on Geraldine Ferraro. And they were talking about her background and everything else and, you know, did everything about her being the first vice presidential nominee for the women's ticket and the whole thing leading up to her nomination as well as what she did when she was working for the prosecution's office, establishing the special victims unit for women and sex crimes and all the good things that she has done. Do you know, Utrice, and all of this hoopla that they did going through all of her career accomplishments and everything that she has done for the women's movement and the NOW and everybody else, the National Organization for Women, and everything that they showed, the convention floors and everything else that she had done in the 84 election. Do you know they did not interview not one black woman You know, I know Barbara Jordan from the state of Texas. She was the first black woman from this state sent to Congress back in the 70s, the same time when Geraldine Ferraro went into Congress in 78, I believe it was, when she went to Congress. Shirley Chisholm from New York also was in Congress when Geraldine Ferraro was there. Geraldine Ferraro represents Queens. You mean to tell me this whole documentary, they did not interview not one black congressperson for this documentary? One black woman was focused on with all of this stuff. This was an hour and a half long documentary to say that, okay, she did all these things for the women's movement, and we're all in this together, but black people was non-existent. The same thing happened when they showed when she did the run-up to the election where she said she went into the booth when she voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2008 election against. And she got all emotional. She said, okay, well, when I went into the booth and I pulled the lever, she said, it was like I was in the booth with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. No mention of Ida B. Wells. No mention of no one's black. And it brings me right back to what I've said all along, is that this movement, that people always like to say that we are in this together, it's always been a white women's movement. That's why I do not classify myself as being a feminist, a womanist, and none of these things, because it's always about white women elevating themselves. They want me in there as a collateral to boost their numbers. But when it comes down to it, I'm not even included in it, because I find it unconscionable that you're going to make a documentary about this woman's career, and we have all of these black women who were the first in the state of New York, and not one of them was interviewed or in any of the clips.
Well, that is what the Kerner Commission of 1965, I believe it was, or 68, I think it was 65, basically said, that the media plays a major role in just underlining or underscoring the racial line of demarcation in the United States. It happens in the newsroom. It happens in the products produced by the newsroom and by people who do documentaries and so forth. Believe it or not, they will tell you that what you just observed is news to them, because that's the world they function in, and that's the way they see the world. So in their view, they're producing something consistent with the way they see the world. And in their world, they do not see everybody. They just don't. I'd like to know who produced it.
One of her daughters did it, because she had her daughter Donna, because she had two daughters and a son. And her daughter, Donna DeRocco, was one of the directors and producer of this documentary on her mother.
So there you go. You have extreme bias there. It was an ode to mom from a daughter. Now, that is one, on one level, you could understand that. I could understand that. But however, if the medium accepting this content fail to recognize what you just pointed out, that's a problem. You know, the daughter's free to make any kind of documentary she wants. She could make a glowing documentary, you know, just refusing to recognize any faults or flaws in her mother. That's fine. But the institution that accepts it and then runs it is now accountable, because somebody ought to go through the material and see the obvious problems with it, and say, no, it's a great thing that you did. It's probably going to be a thing that you call all the relatives together on the anniversary of your mother's death, and we could look at this and share this documentary among ourselves. But for public consumption, it is way, way too biased. And it basically rewrites history.
It wasn't true, because I like Geraldine Ferraro. Geraldine Ferraro, she and my mother, they were born on the same day, August 26th. So I've always admired the woman. But if you're going to go and you're going to document her career being one of the wave of women that came into Congress, Barbara Jordan was one within that wave. Shirley Chisholm was in that wave. As she talked about the first Italian-American. You should always include all of these women of other ethnicity. There was this sister from Hawaii. She was a Japanese-American who was in that wave that came into Congress in the early 70s too. There were a lot of women from other ethnic minority groups who were in this wave of sisterhood. If you want to say, okay, this was the women's movement, the rising up of the women, but it's only the rising up of white women. That's what
but, you
know,
that also is, it's a distortion of historical fact. Geraldine Ferraro's political career was created by and sustained not by the Italian community.
Exactly.
It was African Americans and Latinos for the most part. You know, these are the facts. So, and there were major questions about her relationship with these two communities that became largely ceremonial once she was elevated, following the same pattern. But I don't want to beat up the dead. The fact is that don't blame the documentary. Blame the organization, whichever media outlet that aired it, because somebody should have taken a look at the content and said, it's nice and wonderful, but it wouldn't suit our purposes, because in the end, the media organization is responsible for what goes on the air. And I don't care how great the documentary was, if somebody looked at it with a critical eye, and using standards of what you would consider to be fairness, you would have a problem with airing content that suggested, that all these other women were just not on the scene. It's very bad. Oh, by the way, I would pass along to you, Shakim wrote and said that he wants to give you his best regards. Send his greetings to you. So there you go.
Thank you very much, Patricia. You enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Great. You too. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Thank you. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Utrice. It's always
Hello.
A pleasure to talk with you. Thanks
Same
for
here.
Taking my call. I just wanted to comment briefly on something that you brought up some time ago concerning Dianne Feinstein.
Yes.
And something of my own observations and experience. I lived in San Francisco for about 3 years back some time ago. And I actually lived, like two or three blocks from Dianne Feinstein's house. She lived in a little cul-de-sac with this big mansion with a huge, flagpole, the American flag, and a black limo. I don't think she was ever there. But when I first moved to San Francisco, Mayor Newsom was running for office against Matt Gonzalez of the Green Party. And Mayor Newsom, who won, was a Democrat. There was no Republican running at all. And I said to myself, looking at Dianne Feinstein from time to time, I said, well, how is she elected in, her record, her views, her hawkishness and all that business, how does she get elected in California as a senator? And I started to, think about it, and I say she's so out of touch with somebody that didn't even have a Republican running, and here she is. And then I saw a picture on the front of the New York Times just recently with all this brouhaha with the CIA, and she was sitting there in a very, spiffy business suit. With a black leather clutch, a briefcase. And she had two newspapers under her arm. And I looked carefully, and there were only two. One was the Wall Street Journal, and the other one was the Financial Times, that orangish newspaper.
Yes.
And I looked so carefully because, here she is, with the CIA making a big brouhaha, and I'm looking to see if there's another paper there. No. Then I looked up her net worth. She was one of the five most wealthy senators. And she married this guy Blum, as you mentioned, in 2003. And her net
worth... Actually, Peter Byrne mentioned it. It was his investigative work called Going Postal.
Yeah.
In which he outlined in that book that Dianne Feinstein's husband, Blum, had... a no-bid contract to dispose of U.S. postal property.
Right, and I saw her. She married this guy in 1980, and her net worth was $26 million. And by 2005, her net worth had increased to between $43 million and $99 million. And in 2012, she had up to $108.1 million. And, and you know, they have ways to reduce what is probably much more than that. And it increased so phenomenally that who knows what she's worth today. But she has to, as a congressman, report her wealth between 46 and 108.1 million. Now, can you imagine on any specific Sunday waking up and not knowing whether you had 46 million or 108 million
dollars? Do you attribute this increase in wealth to her savvy ways of investing and her intelligence?
Well, you know, you keep looking into Dianne Feinstein. And how did she get elected? Well, this is part of what I call the baloney show. I think this whole brouhaha with the CIA is created to make her look or appear or seem electable to a mostly, you know, rather liberal or left-leaning, you know, a constituency. But I think it's just a show. She, for example, I think there's a a quid pro quo pro involved in this, because she sits she's haggling with the CIA about this stuff, right? So it looks like she's protecting the public from, you know, from hanky panky by the CIA. That's, you know, she's exposing this. She's, you know, she's like her own Snowden, you know, uncovering the nasty things of government. But comes to see that she sits on the Select Committee of Intelligence, and the other committee that she sits on is the Senate Committee on Appropriations.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see, just, you know, I could just imagine her saying, look, you know, let's get together, put on this show to make me look good to my constituency, and I'm going to give you all these goodies in return for taking a black eye on this, you know?
But, you know, Mrs. Blum is 80 years old, and she intends, I mean, she is not going out of the Senate until somebody with a crowbar comes by and pries her loose from the institution.
But I think her constituency would have pried her loose if it wasn't for these baloney shows that she puts on to make her seem relevant to her constituency.
But she has enough money to become relevant. Even if the constituency doesn't want her or doesn't think she's relevant, she has enough money to fund a campaign that makes her relevant.
Well,
and this is
an
institution,
point.
Really. I mean,
right.
This is the thing. She is an institution in the U.S. Senate. And
look at the committees that she controls. She's the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, and she's on the Appropriations Committee. So she's one of the most powerful actually senators, mm-hmm. from a committee standpoint.
Absolutely. And she has this way of, she carries herself in the old fashioned, you know, the hint of the old world politician, you know, somebody who's above suspicion.
Right.
And somebody who's an institution in and of herself. She's untouchable. Now, Dianne Feinstein should be right now in the middle of a huge investigation about conflict of interest with respect to her husband and perhaps other things, but certainly with respect to her husband, how he got a no-bid contract to handle $80 billion worth of U.S. property.
Yeah.
You know, how does that happen?
Exactly. And where is the investigation? You know, because I think you're right. I think she has so much power, so much money, and that she is sort of an institution. She's untouchable. And I, you know, having lived in San Francisco and knowing, you know, the kind of politics a little bit that was there, you know, I can't figure how she gets the vote. And
well, that's how they accommodate each other. You have a lot of folks in Congress, in the U.S. Senate, and in the House, they accommodate each other's larceny and each other's violations of ethics. They accommodate it because they have so much in common.
Oh, of course.
And plus, it is not a good thing. And few women have been able to do that. Hillary Clinton has kind of done that, but in any event, she does have a history of being the most often subpoenaed first lady in connection with criminal investigations. But when people become institutions, especially if they are women, and this is another angle of the advantages that women take, you know, they somehow get some breathing room because nobody wants to beat up on a woman. Nobody wants, especially a woman who is an institution unto herself.
Correct.
Who wants to do that?
But
who wants
to be
the bad
guy Dianne
coming
Feinstein.
After for Feinstein? Nobody wants to do that.
You don't really connect her, you know, just thought-wise with women's issues. Like you might do with Hillary because, you know. But Dianne Feinstein is like, you know, she's like the military.
This is really a very interesting thing about how people develop what in marketing they call their brand. She has developed a branding, a kind of a persona that basically speaks to her infallibility, or people would be very, very hesitant to go against Feinstein. She is very well connected and she's very protected. And that's why she's been in the Senate since chickens had teeth.
Yeah, yeah. But I can't help thinking that this whole brouhaha with the CIA is just to burnish her image with the, with the constituency that has to elect her.
I think it might be a factor, but I think more than anything else, again, this is a weird kind of interpretation, but I'll put it out there. Democrats have to put some kind of distance between themselves and their titular leader, President Obama. It's not going well for Democrats because people are beginning to wake up in ways that they had not imagined, that his charismatic personality would have, you know, put a nice fluff on all of that. It's not working. Mm-hmm. And many Democrats see themselves now as vulnerable. And in very interesting ways, very diplomatic, and that's one of them. When she came out and attacked the CIA, she basically was sending a message to Obama. Because in a well-run political party, that would never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you would have a leadership that would have corralled that and would have spoken to her and said, you know what, let's deal with this, but let's deal with this quietly and let's see where it goes. Please don't go public with it at this time. But she
it's
has done that to indicate
one way or
distance.
The other.
You know, she's indicating distance, some degree of distance from Obama, and other people have done that in with respect to Obamacare and other decisions that they feel would make them vulnerable at election time. And this is her way of indicating to her public and to the party itself that she is to be viewed as a woman of her own accord. You know, she's on her own, she's impartial, and she's not one of those rabid Democrats. She's one of the old world type politicians. Thanks for your call today.
Thank you.
Just following up on yesterday's comments, we have Nathaniel who said, he was commenting on Obama's speech. He says, the president's speech, as previous presidents, paints the current situation in Ukraine as a threat to freedom and liberty. But we on Lead Stories know this speech shrouds the real goal of the U.S. as that of imperialism, and the real prize is ultimately the natural resources of the Ukraine and Russia. Thank you for that. From Columbus, Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Hope you are too.
Yeah, Yeah, I'm good. That person who said something, made a comment yesterday. You just read it?
Oh, I just, Nathaniel.
Yeah. I think that's correct. You know, I heard some of the speech, and it was just blatant. You know what I mean? It was inaccurate in everything. Just outright lies. Some of the things he said.
That's why I could run only 10 minutes of it, because to run the whole thing would probably set off too many people. So I said, let's minimize the effect to 10 minutes, and that's good.
Sure.
What have you to say today?
Well, I was, I spoke to you a couple weeks ago, and then there was an issue. There's an issue up now in front of the SCOTUS, in front of the Supreme Court, that Hobby Lobby says it's religious freedom to turn mm-hmm. down women in with their contraceptives. And I just want to run this by you and ask you this. I could see the Supreme Court actually siding with Hobby Lobby. But I think also that it would less likely occur if the actual issue, I know this may sound crazy or out there, but if the actual issue were whether or not Hobby Lobby was actually religious.
Well, it's a very interesting case brought before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the first thing that we need to remember is that the U.S. Supreme Court is not necessarily supreme in its decisions. You know, we have a long history of pretty stupid decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, wrong-headed, racist decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. So when people refer to the U.S. Supreme Court with such reverence, we ought to keep in mind that they are, in the end, human beings, and they bring their own thoughts to the process, even though that their job is to interpret the law. Now, the Hobby Lobby case basically comes out of a contention that the Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, is compelling them as a company headed by people who are very religious, and
sure.
It is part, if you will, of their or beliefs in this particular company. That's the argument, that they have particular religious beliefs, and these beliefs are at the core of their company practices.
Sure.
And so to compel a company whose core practices are informed by certain religious beliefs, which include opposition to certain forms of contraception. It's not across the board, because when you look at the case, you see that they have been providing coverage for contraceptives of a particular kind. They're now saying, well, we don't want particular kinds of contraception, we don't believe in, you know.
Sure.
So they're saying that they should not be compelled to provide coverage for that. Now, I don't know how this basically ends up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, except that, again, it shows not so much the problem with the company, and there is a problem with the company that people need to be aware of, because in the broader sense, it says, what, therefore, should an employee be forced to accept the core beliefs of a company if mm-hmm. these beliefs are, you know, not jiving with their own? Or should it actually be a basis for employment at any company? I see it that way. But what it points to more than anything else is this Obamacare. The program is so awful it's so bad that it's going to take years before, if it goes that way, we have to be prepared for at least 20 years of litigation because so many things about Obamacare are so wrong-headed, and they never thought about these things. They just wanted to ram this down the throats of Americans.
Sure, sure. But I still think for me, that's early on. I mean, I think that it is the issue is whether or not they are to actually prove that you're religious. You know, I mean, many tenets of Eastern religion were sought after, splinter society as requisite for resources. You know, I mean, you were talking earlier about the prize of the Ukraine. It's the resources. And so you're able to use religion as if it were a spiritual issue, but in essence, it's an economic stance, you know. And that's what I'm saying, and that should be challenged. You know, you can't prove religion. You can only undermine society for not accepting the claim. And that's how you go for resources.
I really do see the problem as Obamacare itself. It is a really horrible piece of legislation.
Sure. But you can't be divisive as proof, though. You can't legislate religion as proof that you see something wrong with Obamacare. It is okay to understand that about Obamacare, but you can't be divisive as proof. And so perhaps we should deal with the Obamacare issue per se, as you say. But you cannot legislate demand. It is impossible.
Well, here's the thing. At some point in the course of legislation and making laws,
sure,
there has to be a consideration of ultimately the expense any law would cause the public to finance in terms of a defense by the government. And that's the point of legislators. The point of legislation is to, when by the time something becomes a law, you have thoroughly investigated all aspects or as many aspects of the legislation before you pass it to find out where the holes are. And this comes about as a result of debate. This law never was debated. This law came, under the radar and was hustled through Congress. And basically now, they don't care how many, and it will turn out to be, I'll tell you, it will go into the billions of dollars to defend this horrible law, which did not see the light of day. And this is the problem. At some point, the question has to be raised, to what degree should the public actually finance the recklessness of Congress? This is reckless legislation. They knew you can't have a law passed, which clearly to any sane mind, you can see that these things are problematic, and you can see that there would be years and years and years of litigation, which is one thing, but it's the cost of legislation. And this president didn't care. The Democrats don't care. They think that there's going to be enough money ad infinitum, and they'll cause people, Hobby Lobby and others. I mean, I'm not against Hobby Lobby. You know, that's their thing. They want to defend that. They have a right to challenge the court.
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do, because you can't prove religion, no matter how you slice it.
Well, there are some things that people have protections on religious grounds, and
but you can't legislate it. You can't because you can't prove it.
We have legislation that does protect people on, if I were to say, well, I can't come to work today. Today's Daffodil Day, and in my religious belief, daffodils are sacred, and we must not work on Daffodil Day. Well, okay.
Sure, but Hobby Lobby saying that there, no contraceptives per se is not a freedom, because you can't prove that.
Well, these are matters of law. I mean, the interpretation is, and I would say with respect to Hobby Lobby, I have personal beliefs about companies that have these requirements as part of or terms of employment.
Sure.
But ultimately, the bigger problem I see here is that Hobby Lobby is going to be one of 500,000 other lawsuits that will be coming down the pike because this reckless president decided to ram this incomplete, totally undebated law to pass through questionable practices and downright undemocratic principles. They just wanted this thing passed. They couldn't care less. How much money? Taxpayers will be footing the bill to the tune of billions of dollars. And
wait,
on both sides, taxpayers will be paying to defend the bill for the government, and taxpayers will be paying to bring these lawsuits to the government because they will be on the other side being threatened with penalties for breaking the law.
So along with the Supreme Court saying it's constitutional, that's also the problem.
Well, we had a discussion about constitutional disobedience and this whole idea that people in the 21st century have to interpret laws that were made centuries ago. Thanks for your call. Thank you so much. Janelle from California, you're on the air.
Yes. Eudrice, I want to thank you for being a voice of reason in a world full of lies and deceit. Yesterday I heard Obama say that Crimea was worse than the Iraq War. I am so angry and so upset.
I know, it's very upsetting to see, especially on the world stage, our president perform at a standard that is almost embarrassing.
It's immoral. Don't you think, Eudrice? It's immoral.
Well, I don't know about the morality of it, but I do know it's a distortion of the historical record.
Yes, it
and, is. And, you know, when you're head of state on the world stage, now everybody's watching you, and you are representing the collective character of a nation, you should at least not be so embarrassing. You know, say things that are historically correct and defensible.
Exactly. Hey, we have children and grandchildren and people growing up that are, the history's being rewritten. You know, I've watched all these wars. I'm 65 years old. The Vietnam War, Reagan's covert wars in the 80s, then the Bush, Father Bush, and then the Iraq War. These are terrible, terrible travesties. And I can't believe that the head, a Democrat president, could stand up and say that Crimea was even in the ballpark of any of that. And so I would like just to suggest, Eudrice, because I need to free my mind, that people, exactly, but I would suggest that people call the White House and ask them to read history and be correct, because he's representing America on the world stage, as you say, but there's so much more at stake than just him being an embarrassment.
It is very embarrassing because, you know, when you watch the reaction of the people listening to him when he gave the speech in Brussels, and it is hard to not conclude that they were not impressed.
No, their jaws were hanging down.
is this what we hear? It's very embarrassing.
All right, to all your listeners, if they feel so, like I do, please say something about it. Because I think that that's unacceptable myself. And there's so much of that going on in today's world that, and I am so grateful to the journalists and the people like you who will dare to speak the truth. And so that's all I have to say. And thank you so much for letting me free my mind.
Have a good weekend as a result of that. Having freed your mind, you can free up your weekend. DX from LA, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you doing today?
Great. Hope you are too.
I'm doing fine, and I'd like to also say hello to your listeners out there, all the PRN listeners. Man, a lot of things going on in the world. A lot of diverse topics today on the show, which is nice. Appreciate that. I wanted to lighten up the mood a little bit, though, because I'm going to get upset if I talk about some of this stuff. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some technology issues, a couple of things that happened to me this week. Well, we've all heard about physical tracking of where your location is, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. Most people nowadays, they have smartphones, and I've worked with technology and things like that since the late 80s, so I wanted to give a little advice as well. I have an Android phone. Most people either have iPhone, Android, or something like that. And there's a feature on there on all of these.
You're kind of breaking up, DX.
Am I breaking up?
A little bit, yeah.
Can you hear me better now?
I can hear you.
Okay. All right. So there's a feature on most of these phones called GPS Locator.
Oh. Now, speaking of tracking.
Right. And so what most people don't know is that the default most of the time for GPS tracking is on, especially on Android phones. So what I do with mine, I have mine, you have to go into the settings and turn it off so that because the only use most people have for GPS tracking is when you're trying to get from one place to another and you don't have time to write down directions and things like that. It's easier just to look it up. So they have to have your present location in order to tell you where to go. So anyway, here's what I do. I leave mine off until there's somewhere specifically I don't know where to get to and I don't have time to, like I said, write down directions. So I'll leave the house and then I'll turn the tracking back on. And it's pretty simple to do on most phones. You just go into the settings under location or something like that. It's different on every system. But I do that, and I cut it back off when I am finished, when I get to my destination, and then I just come back home. And what I do when I get home, also a good idea, is to take your battery out of your cell phone. And that way, because they can still locate you with your phone off, which is amazing. You know, you can still be tracked. So I do that. I take the battery out. So just to go to another little mini subject here, I was dealing with updating my operating system today on my Mac computer. And it took about an hour, which is a long time. But I noticed this time that the operating system upgrade, I upgraded to the latest one, which is Mavericks. I noticed that it was free. Now, usually you have to pay for these things, and that started some questions in my mind, because as you know, when they give you something free, most of the time it's not really free. You may not have to pay money for it, but you're paying in other ways. So I started reading it's called a EULA, End User License Agreement, and that's what you get on the screen every time you install software and things like that. And if you've never read one of those, you should read it. It takes a while, but it's pretty confusing, but it's all inclusive. So one of the first things they tell you is the difference between you owning the software and them licensing it to you, which is really peculiar to me. So the first couple of paragraphs, they'll say this software is not sold to you, but it's licensed to you. And then they'll explain the difference, that they own the whole protocol, everything involved in the software and everything, basically everything except for your machine. They own it. So you can either agree to the terms or not agree to the terms. Now, you know, if you don't agree to the terms, you don't get the software, obviously. So, you know, you read that agreement. So the thing is, why are they giving it free? And I think, because I don't know if you've noticed or other listeners have noticed, but recently they're tracking your emails and things and advertising to you. They're giving companies the right to, for example, I'll give a quick example. I was emailing someone about a microphone for sale, right? I was emailing back and forth. And so after I sent the initial email, he wrote me back, and I opened the email, and I read it, and then I close it. It's on Yahoo, by the way, Yahoo email. So then I log out of my account. And the next time I log into my account just to check my messages on Yahoo, there's these advertisements on the side for microphones at the Guitar Center, at such and such. So do I think someone's sitting there actually reading your email? No. But they have algorithms and software that can detect algorithms and keywords and things like that that they use to track what you're doing. Now, this is more evil to me, quote unquote, than actual physical tracking, because it gets to your actual heart's desire, your wants and desires. You see
basically, it is a portrait of you. Once they track your interests, they could compile some, basically, your personality, your character, your propensity to make certain kinds of decisions and purchases and all of that. Yeah, it's all part of it.
Absolutely.
And let's see how people react, because that's a very interesting thing. Thank you so much, DX, for calling. From D.C., Mike, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I was not going to call in until I just heard the previous caller talk about one of my most favorite topics. And that's IT-related stuff. But I'm glad he did make that comment, because I was in the same position he was a few days ago. And I, just like him, I refuse to just install the latest version of that operating system. And it was just something instinctive in me. I don't just take stuff just because people offer it to me. Like, just because it's free doesn't necessarily mean it's good for me. So I thought that was really, really poignant, him talking about that. The second thing that he talked about the tracking, he's absolutely right. And what he's talking about is called deep packet inspection. And it's something that computers and analysts use to basically, like he said, write algorithms to probe what you're doing online. So people are that you are being tracked. Everything you're doing is being monitored, not in real time, but, you know, they can go back and kind of build stuff. So that's all I wanted to do, was just call in and kind of echo what he was saying.
Thank you so much, Mike. Thank
no
you for
problem.
Your call today.
Sure.
From Brooklyn, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. I want to go back to I think it was Monday's show where you talked about women, what is a woman, and we talked about the early feminists, the early suffragettes, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned about Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and what their attitude was in relation to the voting issue. It was the 15th Amendment, I believe. And you mentioned that they wanted the vote for women, but they seemed to be unwilling to extend that same right to the former slaves.
Or to black women.
Not just black women.
Or to black women.
Well, that they were among the former slaves. So, but anyway, that more or less overturned what my impression of those people, of the early suffragettes, had been. And so I said, this is something I have to go and look up, because I mean, that's a good thing when you when you get former impressions overturned. And, you know, and you have to revisit things. That's a good thing. It's a learning experience. So So I went to Wikipedia, which I've read problems with it, but I don't know, I find it a good source of in-depth articles that you know, they're long, but they're not super long, and they're not you can get a quick read on things, and they give a very different impression about what they. It sounds like what you were talking about was a split that happened between Frederick Douglass and those two women, as well as a split between those two women and other factions of the suffragette movement. And they describe it very differently. It was basically a strategy split, because the 15th Amendment was going to give the vote basically to black males and was going to leave women out. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton wanted to hold out and have it all have the suffrage extended to everybody. And in fact, that was Susan B. Anthony's, according to Wikipedia's biography of her, that was her intention all along. She was like possibly the most radical of them all. She wanted complete citizens' rights for all people, including all the former slaves. The problem came in with the 14th Amendment, which was kind of a complicated language. Because voting rights were controlled by states, and so they had to extend some kind of control. They wanted to extend some kind of control over voting rights that the states would have to oblige by, and so they introduced the word male into the Constitution for the first time.
But all of this still comes down to the bottom line. Now, the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment had application to whites, but not to Africans in the United States. The 14th
Amendment
basically never recognized African Americans as citizens of the United States. So it would be crazy to suggest that they had a strategic difference about that. The women's movement, the suffragette movement was about empowering women, and they were very clear, not just all women, but white women who stood at that, in their reasoning at that time, as far more strategically capable of succeeding at it than any other group. Women, white women, who very often, of course, were married or associated with white men of property. So the 14th Amendment did not apply to African Americans at all, because, you know, that was before the Dred Scott decision that says basically you have no rights because you're not a citizen the United States. Well, that's the first part. The second part, where you talk about the 15th Amendment, about the vote, African Americans didn't have rights as people, let alone the right to vote. So when Frederick Douglass went campaigning very strenuously, both in the United States and abroad, to carry this message about freedom for women, because he allied it with freedom for all people, and got that level of interest, they were very happy about his influence, because it was very powerful and it advanced the argument for women's suffrage. But when it came time for them to be very clear that they also stood in support of freedom for African Americans, they just balked. Now, they could call it the strategic difference if they want, but the fact is,
no, they didn't do it. That wasn't the way it was, at least according to what I read. The split was whether blacks and women should get the vote at the same time, or whether, because the 15th Amendment, the proposed 15th Amendment, was going to extend voting rights to former slaves. And,
listen to that phrase, though. How do you extend voting rights to former slaves without first getting past the question about slaves as people, citizens?
Well, slaves were already citizens. The 13th Amendment ended slavery. So the 13th Amendment gave them citizenship, but still the states controlled voting. And so,
can I ask you a question about the 13th? Was the 13th Amendment actually ratified?
That I don't know. I mean, I assume it was.
Check on that, because, you know, this is the interesting game that happens in terms of history that would make you believe that these things were already there. No, that there was a huge, huge turmoil about this. When it comes to the suffrage movement and the anti-slavery movement, we have the question, and it still stands in my view, that when the time came to be unambiguous in their support for freedom of people of African descent in the United States, they balked.
All the early suffragettes were originally abolitionists. They all came from the abolitionist background. Susan B. Anthony especially was an ardent abolitionist. And when the Civil War happened, the entire suffragette movement was put on hold, went dormant while they all worked for
that's a hint. We got to go. We'll pick this up. I think it's a very interesting question, and we should explore it in one of our regular programs. We should. Thanks so much. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Thanks for being with me today.